the evidence shows that absentee ballot fraud from mail-in votes is vanishingly small. Five states have been doing it for years without any problems, including blood red Utah. We see perhaps some manipulation of the post office to make it more difficult to deliver ballots. And Trump, in a moment of candor, openly admitted that if we had high voter turnout in America, that Republicans would never win another election. They benefit from restricting the vote. That keeps me up at night.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Professor Alan Lichtman of American University is a historian with a long career that's filled with numerous articles, books, expert witness testimony in civil rights cases, political predictions, and media appearances about American politics. Many of his books use history to urge progressive policy change. His Keys to the White House prediction says that Biden will defeat Trump in November of 2020. I hope he got this one right. He was a fun person to talk to about how to build a wide-ranging career and about our current politics. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Professor Alan Lichtman.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Alan J. Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History, American University in Washington, D.C. Grew up on the hard knock streets of Brooklyn, New York. I went to the famous Stuyvesant High School, the breeder of scientists, but I took a different direction in college. I was a history major at Brandeis, got my PhD from Harvard University in 1973, and have been teaching at American University in Washington, D.C. for now, I guess, 46 years. I've written about a dozen books, authored or co-authored, over 200 scholarly and popular articles. I've been an expert witness in about 100 civil rights cases, including many landmark civil rights cases. I've done commentary, I think, probably for every print and media outlet that's major anywhere in the world. I've lectured all over the world. I discovered for the United States Commission on Civil Rights what really happened in Florida's 2000 presidential election and why the wrong president was chosen in 2000. And of course, since 1984, I've been using my 13 keys to the White House to predict the outcomes of American presidential elections. I also have some odd, interesting things in my background. I was the big quiz show television money winner of 1981, winning over $100,000 in cash and prizes on the great show Tic-Tac-Doe with Wink Martindale, defeated 20 opponents. And I was an age group North American champion in the 3,000-meter steeplechase, a race designed for horses but run by people. I'm married to a political activist, Karen Strickler, the head of a Vote Climate U.S. PAC, a PAC devoted to combating climate change. She was also a feminist activist who was instrumental in codifying Roe versus Wade in Maryland way back in the early 1990s, so the women of Maryland are protected. And she is an Ironman triathlete and an age group winner. And the Ironman is a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike and a 26.2-mile run. I have two children, Kara, who is a psychiatrist in Brooklyn, and Sam, who is an MFA graduate from Emerson, a Dean Scholar, and who helps me with all the technology for my interviews.
That's a very capable recitation of a biography, almost as if you're well aware of your own life there, and quite impressive. I'm glad I have the chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you.
I feel a kind of a kinship to a quiz show champion because my dad has two lines in movie history because of his time on the Cornell College Bowl team.
Oh, and sure.
A little clip from that showed up in Diner. And so my family has been very alert to that sort of thing ever since. But congrats on that. Sounds like it was a lot of fun.
It was fun, except for, 5 years of hassle with the IRS afterwards.
Yes. I'm quite confident my dad was uncompensated.
Sure that's true.
Yeah. I'm always curious about kind of the road that people take when you seem to have found a really great place for yourself. If you stay 46 years at one university and you've got all these things going on, I think that speaks to a fair amount of happiness. Can you tell me about the road there in a little more detail? So you said you went to Brandeis, history major there?
Let me get into it. It's a little more complicated than that. The road was not straightforward.
Okay.
I think I mentioned to you, I went to Stuyvesant High School.
You did.
I graduated in 1963. And even all boys then. And it was the breeding ground of scientists and doctors. And I was going to be my son, the Jewish doctor, right? And so I went to Brandeis. I was going to be my son, the Jewish doctor. Was a bio major, took the med boards, and was all set to go to medical school. Senior year, I realized several things. One, didn't like being around sick people. Two, I hated the sight of blood. And three, I was really clumsy with instruments and in the laboratory. And I'm thinking, do I really want to be a doctor? And one of the things I did in college and in high school, I was captain of the debate team. And that opened up a whole kind of non-scientific, social scientific world for me. I was New York, New England debate champion. And so I decided I'm going to make a huge switch. And senior year, I walked into the dean's office and I said, Dean Scan, I'm dropping out of the medical program, pre-med. And he said, you can't do that. You finished it. You even took the med board. I was 19 years old, but I had enough presence of mind to say, I'm sorry, it's my life. I'm doing it. But he said, no one's ever done that. And I said, I don't care. It's what I want to do. And he said, okay, Lichtman, what are you going to do instead of going to medical school? I said, I am going to history graduate school. The dean got this funny look on his face. He looked at me and he said, Lichtman, you're crazy. Nobody could understand why you give up medical school for something as silly as history graduate school. And it was a very close call, given my debate experience, between history grad school and law school. And I decided for history grad school because as an historian, you can study anything, science, diplomacy, politics, family life, anything falls under the purview of history. And I originally went to Harvard with the idea of studying diplomatic history. But my very first semester there, I ran into one of my old professors from Brandeis, very eminent historian, Morton Keller. And he was carrying the sheaf of papers under his arm. Remember, this is 1967 or so. And I said, what's that? And he said, computer printout. That was not common in those days. And I said, what's printed out? He said, well, there are all these election statistics. And he said, I don't understand them. But if anyone could figure them out, they'd have a great paper. And I said, paper, I need to write my seminar paper. And I was a science major. I could figure that out. And that led me into a totally different direction of becoming a quantitative political historian.
You probably made an incredibly good decision for your life, because I've talked to a lot of people in their 40s and 50s who went on to be a lawyer or doctor because they were supposed to, who aren't that happy. I don't know how that would have turned out for you, but sounds like you went the right road.
I'm absolutely convinced I went the right road. And of course, greatness can skip generations. And my daughter is a doctor. I think I mentioned she is a psychiatrist in Brooklyn, and very happy and doing very well. But I'm really happy with what I did because it has led me into so many different directions. Yes, I write history, but I also do political commentary. I also do political prediction. I also write crossover books that are popular. I write columns. I comment on radio and television. I've been an expert witness in 100 civil rights cases. So being an historian has been like a base for doing so many different kinds of things.
Well, it's a kind of a entrepreneurial career within the department, it sounds like. What was your dissertation on at Harvard?
My dissertation was a quantitative study of the American presidential election of 1928, which was published as one of my first books, which was called Prejudice and the Old Politics, the Presidential Election of 1928, which was unique because it was the first Catholic ever to run for president, Al Smith, at a time when the nation was in the grips of rampant anti-Catholicism. And I did a quantitative study, one of the first major quantitative election studies of that election and elections leading up to it and following it using mathematical methodologies I had learned as a science major and then further perfected as a graduate student. And as I said, that was published around 1979 or so by the University of North Carolina Press.
What did you find in that analysis?
Well, I found some really important things. One, the reason it's called Prejudice in the Old Politics is indeed anti-Catholic prejudice very much shaped the vote. It might not have caused Smith to lose because Republicans were not going to lose in the midst of 1920s prosperity, but it greatly shaped the vote. You had this enormous religious divide in voting, where Smith won the overwhelming majority of the Catholic vote, but only about 30% of the Protestant vote in this country. The other thing I learned was this was not a transformational election. This was not the election that led to the great Democratic comeback of the 1930s, but rather the transformational elections occurred after 1928, from 1930 to 1936.
You seem to allude to some twists and turns, I'm assuming, between grad school and American, but how did you land at American?
Like so much else in life, I landed there by accident. And actually, the only thing I'd heard about American University was they had, I think it was Kermit Washington, a guy who made the pros and then punched out another.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it, but you know, 73 was a tough year, a tough economic year. It was very hard to get a job. And this job really appealed to me because it was in Washington, D.C. Political historian, what better place to be? But it was only a one-year job. And so I was searching for other jobs during my 1 year and I actually got a job at CUNY, City University of New York. And I was about to call them and say, I'm coming, when one of our senior professors, very famous historian, Robert Beisner, grabbed my wrist and stopped me from calling. And he said, don't call. We're going to give you a regular position. And I got a tenure track position. And then I got an offer from the University of Amsterdam. And here I am, my 20s, to be a full European professor, which is much more prestigious and harder to get than a full US professor, and to be head of American Studies at the University of Amsterdam, my own building, my own department. And I was very tempted to take it, But our dean said, don't take it. We're going to give you a huge salary boost, and we're going to make you a full professor at the age of 30.
What was it that you were doing so early in your career that made the administration at American so careful to retain you?
Several things. One, as I always tell my son, you get a new job, make yourself indispensable. Do things that no one else can do. And I was doing some things that no one else was doing. First of all, I was a pioneer in this kind of new history that was just rising up in the 1970s, the use of mathematical methods and social science models to understand the past. As I said, what became my book and my dissertation was a quantitative study of early 20th century presidential elections focused on 1920. Secondly, I was publishing like crazy, publishing two or three books in my 20s or around 30, publishing quite a number of articles, including one in the leading journal in the field, and that is the American Historical Review, very, very rare. And finally, focusing on teaching. In those days, we had very heavy teaching loads, three courses a semester. Now it's two courses a semester, and mine is less because I'm a distinguished professor. But I tried to combine being an indispensable teacher with being an indispensable scholar and pioneering new areas of historical scholarship.
It sounds like quite a work ethic. What was driving you to have so much output?
You know, my wife always asks me that, and my answer is sheer terror. You know, every day I'm thinking, all right, you know, what can I do to kind of justify my existence here? I've also been guided by an old saying of Horace Mann, and I'm paraphrasing, be ashamed to die until you've at least won one small battle for humanity. I've always wanted to win at least small battles for humanity, if not big ones.
You have a number of books of late that make it very clear that you're, you know, on the liberal progressive side. And sounds like that is a theme throughout your career. Can you make clear why that's the side of the sort of big battle in our country that you're on?
Yeah, I've been on this for some time, and I like to call myself a progressive with a libertarian streak. My slogan has always been, there's too much government intruding in our private lives and too little government meeting our needs. You know, I grew up in a liberal household in Brooklyn, New York. You know, someone wrote a memoir about growing up in Brooklyn who once said, the most conservative people I ever knew were liberal Democrats. So that was me. There were way more people to my left in Brooklyn, and certainly at Brandeis in the 1960s. I was a Robert Kennedy Democrat, which put me way to the right at Brandeis. You know, they were Trotskyites and Maoists, and you can imagine. And I'm still a Robert Kennedy Democrat, and now I am somewhat to the left. You know, I've always believed in the power of government to do good, but not at the same time be too intrusive. I've always had great empathy for those who are not rich and powerful and influential.
Those books that I was thinking about are one about repealing the Second Amendment, one about the embattled vote, the case for impeachment. It seemed very focused kind of histories in pursuit of a particular change in how we govern. Tell me a little about those three.
Yes. I've always had as my guiding light the notion that on the one hand, studying the past is worthwhile unto itself, and I admire historians who do that. But for me, you know, having this fire in my belly to improve the world, I've always felt that I should be using my historical knowledge and my historical expertise on behalf of social economic justice. And so all of these books I call crossover books. They are solidly rooted in history, but they use history in order to make important points about where policy should be going these days. So, for example, in my book on repeal of the Second Amendment, I go deeply into the history of the passage of the Second Amendment to show it was never meant to provide an unlimited right to keep and bear arms, and that's part of the arsenal of my argument with respect to the need to repeal the amendment today to make a safer country, or the respect to my book on the vote. I go deeply into history to show that throughout our history, this cry of voter fraud has been a phony excuse for excluding people from the ballot, including black people and women. The cry was, oh, the black vote will be bought, the women vote will be bought, it will be rampant fraud. Of course, none of that was true. And I use that to debunk today's arguments, you know, that we have to have all of these restrictions on the vote to prevent fraud. It's not true historically, it's not true today.
What about the impeachment book?
The impeachment book is in fact based almost entirely on history. I probe the full history of Donald Trump to show that this is someone who has no respect for the law, going all the way back to flouting the Fair Housing Act in the 1970s by discriminating against minorities in New York in his real estate company, that this was someone who had no respect for the truth, you know, who got into politics on the back of the biggest, most protracted, worst lie in the history of American politics, that our first African-American president was actually illegitimate because he wasn't born in the U.S. That made him a political figure back in 2011, 2012. I also saw through my study of his history that this was someone who had no empathy for anyone else, who cared only for himself and his own profit, his own ego. And I saw these were the kinds of qualities that would lead someone to commit the transgressions that would lead to impeachment. And I my book came out in April of 2017, right at the very beginning of the Trump administration, and virtually everything I talked about since has come to pass.
It's been a hard presidency to watch. How do your peers, other historians, view the breadth of your accomplishments and being a media figure? I mean, I've talked to like Julian Zelizer at Princeton, who also writes a lot and is out there making a case. But how does the profession view that kind of career?
At first, very negatively. I don't know if it was jealousy or kind of a belief that there has to be a certain purity in academic study, which should not be polluted by a concern with contemporary issues. So, you know, it may have been a little bit of both, but the truth is, you know, for my colleagues who looked askance a bit at this, I've never known one of them ever to turn down a media interview. But over time, what's been called public history has really come into its own. We tend to think of public history as library work or museum or archives. But what I do is public history, taking my expertise and knowledge in history and applying it to understanding contemporary events and to proposing reforms that I think can make our life and our society better. And with the rise of public history, there's been a lot more tolerance and even admiration for someone like myself, who is both an academic historian and a public figure. Indeed, there was interesting review of my book on the embattled vote in America, which said, you know, this book kind of reveals both sides of Professor Lichtman. You know, 2/3 of the book is a detailed historical study of the vote, and then his political activism comes out with his attacks on voter suppression and his proposal for things like automatic voter registration, same-day registration.
One of the things that you mentioned was the Florida election of 2000 and the outcome. And that was a, you know, hugely pivotal, almost coin flip that came down the wrong way in the Supreme Court and put Bush in instead of Gore. What was your involvement there exactly? And why do you think that Gore really won?
Two reasons. First, let me explain my involvement when I discovered I was asked by the United States Commission on Civil Rights, which is a commission that's been longstanding within government that was pivotal in the adoption of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1964. And they asked me to look into racial disparities in ballot rejection. 180,000 ballots were tossed in Florida in 2000 as invalid. And what I found was astounded me. I had no idea. I found that one out of every 9 to 10 ballots cast by an African-American voter was tossed as invalid. And 2/3 of them were not the hanging chads or the dimples. They were overvotes. A lot of African-Americans punched in Gore and, to be sure, wrote in Gore. All those ballots were invalidated, and none of them were recounted. In comparison to the 1 out of 9 ballots cast by African-Americans that were tossed. And by the way, these were people who thought they voted. These were not people who had kept from the polling place. 1 out of 50 ballots cast by whites were discarded. If the percentage of ballots discarded for African-American voters were the same, not zero, but the same as the percentage of ballots cast by whites that were discarded, more than 40,000 additional African-Americans would have cast ballots and Gore would have won going away. Moreover, there was a study, not done by me, but by another academic, of the overvotes, the ones that were never recounted. And that study concluded that Gore should have netted an additional 20,000 or so votes, more than enough to win going away. Plus, I didn't do this, but we also know they purge voters based on a very flawed voting list that overrepresented African Americans. So the wrong candidate won Florida and the wrong candidate became president.
So are you saying that if they'd done a full recount, they would have discovered that? And
if they had recounted the overvotes, yes, but they didn't under Florida law. Other states do recount overvotes, which is perfectly legitimate to try to figure out the actual intent of the voters, which is what this academic study did.
If a white person both checked a box and wrote in Gore or wrote in Bush, they would have also been disallowed?
Correct. But we saw the vast disparity in disallowed African-American votes as compared to white votes.
So if you went by the intent of the voter, Gore would have easily won Florida or, you know, won it pretty solidly.
That's correct. By tens of thousands of votes. The exit polls were right that called the election for Gore. They couldn't take into account, though, what happened with the discarded ballots.
Very hard to hear.
I call it the most significant unknown scandal of the 21st century. And Florida was sued and did reach a settlement with the plaintiffs about improving the way they went about administering elections.
What do you worry most about in the run-up to 2020 that you think might change potentially the outcome in a state from what the intents of the voter would be?
Yes.
To a different result?
Two things. One is voter suppression, like we saw in Florida in 2000. The Republican voter base is old white guys like me. Well, you can't manufacture more old white guys. You can't make us live to be 150. But what you can do is try to suppress the votes of the rising Democratic base of minorities and young people. That base is rising. The base of old white guys is falling. And we see Trump trying to do that quite desperately by denigrating and attacking mail-in voting, which is a perfectly reasonable alternative during the pandemic to voting in person. And the evidence shows that absentee ballot fraud from mail-in votes is vanishingly small. 5 states have been doing it for years without any problems, including blood red Utah. And even the first time they did it, there were no big problems. We see perhaps some manipulation of the post office to make it more difficult to deliver ballots. And Trump, in a moment of candor, openly admitted that if we had high voter turnout in America, that Republicans would never win another election. They benefit from restricting the vote. That keeps me up at night. The other thing that keeps me up at night is Russian intervention. We know the Russians are back, and they learned things over 4 years. They may even be somewhat successful in getting into voter registration rolls, and heaven forbid what that would do to the election. And we know for certain, Trump has essentially admitted it, that if the Russians intervene again on his behalf, he will welcome and exploit to the hilt Russian meddling in our elections.
How did you originally get into the expert witnessing part of your career?
Just like I got into political prediction, it was kind of by accident. I was contacted by folks working for the John Anderson independent campaign in 1980. And at the time, it was very difficult to get on the ballot, very hard for a candidate like Anderson. So they filed suit, and I was asked to write a paper on the role of third-party and independent campaigns in presidential elections. That was my first involvement, but that did not immediately lead to further involvement. It was a few years later that I was contacted by Steve Rosenbaum of the voting section of the Department of Justice, who had seen some of my works in quantitative history, and he asked me to be an expert witness in one of the Justice Department cases. And that was very successful, and that began an avalanche of expert witness work on behalf of the Department of Justice, on behalf of private plaintiffs, on behalf of numerous civil rights organizations, sometimes on behalf of state and local governments, and I've been involved in about 100 civil rights cases, including the big cases in places like Florida and Texas, Virginia, Wisconsin, California.
Of all those cases, is there one you're most proud of?
Yes. Selma, Alabama. You know Selma, Alabama is the birthplace of the Voting Rights Act. It is the scene of Bloody Sunday in March of 1965, in which John Lewis and others were brutally attacked and beaten by police forces when they were marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. But the birthplace of the Voting Rights Act was a place where African Americans were being denied the opportunity to elect candidates of their choice because in Dallas County, Selma was the county seat of Dallas County, and in Selma, all elections were conducted at large. That is, the entire electorate voted for every county commission or city council position. And so the white voting majority voted in all white officials. And this went on for nearly 25 years till the late 1980s after the enactment of the Voting Rights Act. And I was the expert for the United States Department of Justice in Dallas County and in Selma. And we had an old-fashioned, a segregationist judge, Judge E. Brevard Hand. And it was just incredible. Walking into Selma in the 1980s was like walking into Selma in the 1840s. Whites held all the prestigious positions. Black folks waited on tables, cleaned the streets, made beds and bussed hotel rooms. The black community barely had paved streets. The houses were dilapidated. Public services were almost non-existent. And Judge Hand's courtroom was astonishing. You know, you think of federal court as these very austere, incredibly magnificent courtrooms. It wasn't like that at all. This was a courtroom that could have been from the 1840s. And Judge Hand didn't sit in the bench. He sat in the radiator. He walked around the courtroom. He ruffled the hair of the attorneys. When I got up to testify for the second time, he said, "Oh, no, not Dr. Lichtman again. You're just going to say whatever the Justice Department says you're going to say." And of course, that's entirely untrue. Well, twice we lost in front of Judge Hand. But finally, on the second time it went to the circuit court said, "That's enough. It's time in Dallas County to have a real election." And I was appointed to draw a fair district map for Dallas County and then for Selma that included two white districts, two black districts, and one swing district. And finally, under that plan, which was known as the Lichtman Plan, the first African Americans were elected, and we had an African American majority in the Selma County Commission. And I went down to Selma to celebrate the election of African Americans. And the wise guy editor, Al Benn, of the local paper, put up this huge sign. Let me tell you why. One of the white members of the county commission said, if we adopt this plan, we might as well change the name of Dallas County, Alabama, to Lickman County, Alabama. And Al Benn put up this huge sign over Main Street saying, welcome to Lickman County, Alabama. I was lucky to get out of there, you know, with my life.
It sounds pretty fulfilling.
It was incredibly fulfilling. For the first time in their lives, the black people in Dallas County had someone on their side and someone who was willing to hit the teeth of the white power structure that had kept them under their heel literally for, you know, well over 100 years.
So you've talked about being a debate guy, debate champion, performance on the quiz show here in court. What advice do you have to people who struggle with performance under pressure or who would like to get better at it?
I have one piece of advice. I actually have three. Preparation, preparation, preparation. I've been doing this, you know, for nearly 40 years, and I still prepare like crazy for every deposition, every court appearance. If you are well prepared and you know your stuff, then there's absolutely no reason to be nervous, absolutely no reason to doubt that you are going to be able to perform effectively. And practice. Prepare and practice.
Well, that makes sense and is pretty straightforward. You have in your books several about sort of politics and prejudice. We talked briefly about the 1928 election. You have a book called White Protestant Nation, which hints at what was coming with Trump. I'm just curious how you think prejudice was used by Trump, how surprising it was, how well it worked, and what we can do to kind of try to move away from that in our politics.
Yeah, sadly, prejudice and bigotry is as American as apple pie. It's been around, as we know, as long as the Republic. After all, we had slavery until 1865. Then we had Jim Crow until the Voting Rights Act of 65 and the Civil Rights Act of 1965. And even then, of course, bigotry and prejudice survives, and Donald Trump absolutely played upon this. But I think the way to combat it is to realize that that is the American past. It's not the American future. The American future is a diverse and tolerant nation. We are going to be, in two or three decades, a majority-minority nation. The purveyors of prejudice like Donald Trump are fighting a losing rearguard battle. And we need to recognize what works for America and what America's future is. The best of America has always been when we celebrate, embrace, and tolerate diversity. Look, you know, Donald Trump has whipped up all this prejudice against Mexican immigrants, against Muslims. Well, actually, the first restrictive immigration laws were passed in 1798, and the targets then were Canadians and the French. And then the targets were the Irish, the Italians, the Germans, the Jews. It's always someone, yet every one of these groups has proven that they have made enormous contributions to American life. And the prejudice was completely misguided.
We haven't had a chance yet to talk about keys to victory. And what I want to ask you first is, there are a lot of political scientists and others, economists, who are in the business of prediction, who make regression models or more complicated models based on economics and presidential popularity and other factors like incumbency, and do pretty well. Who of the other predictors do you hold in high regard?
Well, I hold them all in high regard. Ray Fair, Helmut Norpoth, Professor Jones, Professor Kuzan, they're all wonderful people, but I have problems with the way they predict. Let me tell you a story again, because I think you'll be interested. When I first came up with the keys to the White House and made my first prediction, I was derided by all these professional predictors because I had committed the ultimate sin, the sin of subjectivity. That is, not all of my indicators are cut and dry. Some of them involve judgment. And I kept telling them, we're dealing with human beings. Historians make judgment all the time. That's legitimate. Well, it took about 10 or 15 years, and suddenly the professional forecasting world realized that these purely objective models, no matter how big and complicated they are, don't work. And what works best is a combination like the keys of cut and dry, purely objective indicators and judgmental indicators. And suddenly the keys to the White House were the hottest thing in forecasting. I twice keynoted the International Forecasting Summit. I published in all the major forecasting journals. Today, I am part of a symposium in a leading political science journal, two of them. I am speaking at the American Political Science Association convention in a session entitled Classical Models of Prediction. Now, the problem with the big regression models is they have parameters, right?
Right.
And those parameters are weights, in effect. And those weighted models are very good at predicting elections when they know the answer. The problem is the weights change unpredictably from one election to the next, which is why some of the models will get it right and some of the models will get it wrong. And there's really no difference among the models. The secret to the keys is that all keys are equally weighted. They all count one. And the answer to the criticism of, well, how can you say the Great Depression only counted for two economic keys? The answer and the secret to the effectiveness of the keys is trigger effects. If one factor is big enough, it's going to trigger other keys. So the Great Depression triggered social unrest. That's a key. It triggered Republican losses in the midterm elections of 1930. Another key. It triggered a charismatic Democrat, Franklin Roosevelt, to run in 1932, who had no intention of running. Or the Vietnam War triggered social unrest. It forced Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent, not to seek re-election. That's another key. It produced an enormous battle within the Democratic Party. That is another key. Or the pandemic. I don't have a key for the pandemic, but the pandemic triggered other keys. It triggered the deep recession. It triggered a decline in economic growth that cost Trump the long-term economy key. That's two keys. And it certainly contributed to social unrest, which is a third key. So if something is big enough, it'll trigger other keys. But once you put in weights, you make mistakes.
So what is the consensus, or is there, among predictors of 2020? You have somewhat narrowly predicted Trump to lose. What are you seeing out there among others?
Well, the biggest contrarian prediction that I've seen was by a very fine political scientist, Helmut Norquist. And he predicted a Trump landslide. But his model is fundamentally flawed because his model is primarily based on performance in the New Hampshire and South Carolina primaries. How well do the final candidates do? Well, Trump had no opponent. So of course he was going to rack up, 85% of the vote in those primaries. Biden had lots of opponents. So of course he was going to fall behind. So the model automatically picks Trump. It's automatically biased to incumbent presidents and therefore, in my view, does not accurately gauge 2020. You mentioned they're primarily based on presidential approval, which is just a poll. Polls change unpredictably. They're not predictors. And the economy, which is important, but another secret to the keys is it's not based on the economy alone. It's based on a whole host of factors that deal with the performance and strength of the party in power. That's why there are 13 keys, not three keys.
Anyone who follows politics closely, as you do, has a inclination about who you think is going to win, right? Just based on a lot more than keys, based on a lot more information. To what extent do you think some of those judgment calls that you make are made with that all that other information in mind?
Well, they're certainly made with a lot of information. but that information is applied within the keys, which accurately assess the real dynamics of an election, which is the vote up or down on whether or not the party holding the White House should get another 4 years. All of these other indicators of polls, punditry, debates, speeches, fundraising, ads, have never been proven to have any influence whatsoever on the outcome of a presidential election. That's why, based on those, I call them random indicators because they're not based on a solid theory of how elections work, we're so wrong in 2016. Because based on all of those, you know, conventional wisdom factors, Hillary Clinton should have won in a landslide. She won every debate. She had better operations. She had better fundraising. She was ahead on the issues. There was really nothing to suggest that Donald Trump would win that election other than properly modeling the real dynamics of an election, which showed that was going to be a change election, just like this year is going to be a change election.
Why should someone read this book about the keys to victory?
Two reasons. Well, several reasons. One, if you really want to understand how presidential elections work, you should read the book. Number two, the keys to the White House, unlike all these other systems, every one of them is a do-it-yourself system. You can read the book, understand how each key is based. You can't do that just from the cheat sheet of the 13 keys. You can see how every key has been turned from 1860 through 2016, and you can answer the keys yourself. The other thing you learn from the book is, unlike all the other models and the polls, it tells you exactly what are the factors that turn an election one way or the other. And you can start turning the keys right away, right after an election takes place. And the final thing, which may be the most important, if you read the book, there's a section called Campaigning by the Keys, and it suggests a whole different way of campaigning. Forget the attacks, forget the ads, forget the conventional speeches. You should campaign as you govern. You should be campaigning for one purpose and one purpose only, to build a mandate and a grassroots base for governing once you get elected. That's going to help you if you win to govern, and if it helps you to govern, that will help you or your party to win the next election.
That makes a lot of sense. If you're wrong on this election and Trump prevails, which would really make me very sad and cause another very difficult 4 years, if he happens to win for whatever reason, why? What went wrong with your prediction?
Well, let me say this. I'm human. I can make mistakes. I can be wrong. I don't have a pipeline to God. My predictions are based on history. But they've got a pretty damn good track record. If I'm wrong, I think these two factors outside the keys will have given Trump the victory. One, he will have succeeded in suppressing the Democratic base vote, so it will not be a free and fair election. And two, the Russians will have so badly manipulated the election in the favor of Donald Trump that it'll be Vladimir Putin, not the American people, that made their choice.
I mean, he does have a way of creating his own reality, one that's often based on lies about what's going on, and he's at it every day. Might that be the reason?
No, because what he says doesn't matter. I have a whole chapter in my book, The Case for Impeachment, which came out in early 2017, called Lies, Lies, Lies. Donald Trump has been a liar throughout his life. In fact, he burst into politics in 2011, 2012. On the back of the biggest, most protracted, worst lie in the history of the country. That lie was that our first African-American president was illegitimate because he was born outside the United States. That popped him for a while until he withdrew to be at the head of the polls in the Republican nomination battle in 2012. Lies have worked for him and he hasn't stopped. The fact checkers, the Washington Post, have documented over 20,000, misleading and false statements that Trump has issued so far, far more than all other presidents combined. And lies work. They do create an alternative reality. They've admitted it. They've talked about alternative facts. Well, there aren't alternative facts. There are facts based in reality and facts based that you simply make up. The problem for Trump, though, is he has lied so often for so long that he's lost his credibility. 60% or more of the American people, including some who are supportive of Trump, believe he is not honest and trustworthy. So he may have taken his lying as far as it's going to go. And he certainly turned off the great majority of the American people who disapprove of his response to the pandemic with his egregious lies about the pandemic. You know, in March, anyone who wanted a test could get a test. That's still not even true months later. Repeatedly saying the pandemic was under control when it wasn't even close to being under control, saying 99% of cases are harmless, which is grossly untrue, saying most children are immune, which is also untrue. We've just seen a big spike in COVID cases among children. So I think he may have taken lying as far as it's going to go. You know, one of the most precious things a president has is credibility. And I think Trump has lost that.
Is there a question that I haven't asked that you'd like to answer?
I think you've really covered it extremely well. Let me think. But, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. Every 4 years, I put myself on the line with an advance prediction. Frankly, every 4 years, I make half the country really mad at me. And having done this for 40 years, the whole country is probably really, really mad at me. But because I put myself on the line so often, you would think I'm kind of a nerd to it. I'm not. Every time I make a prediction, I have these terrible butterflies in my stomach. I have them right now.
That's fascinating. You've mentioned that you are a former steeplechase runner. I guess we're back in the 1970s.
Correct.
What the heck is a 3,000-meter steeplechase race for a human?
Yeah. You know, when I was on Tic-Tac-Toe, the quiz show, they didn't want me to talk about being a professor. No. But they loved the shtick of the 3,000-meter steeplechase, a race designed for horses but run by people. 3,000 meters is a little less than 2 miles, and you jump over barriers, not hurdles that fall if you hit them, barriers that break your bones if you hit them. Not as high as the high hurdles, but you know, when you do it for 3,000 meters, that's a lot of barriers to jump. And then there's a water jump. You gotta jump over water. And my trick into winning steeplechase was not to try to get out ahead, because everybody piles up at the water jump and crash into each other. But for the first water jump to lag behind a little and then have a clear water jump, which will propel me to getting ahead. I haven't run the steeplechase in decades, but I still run, even at 73, almost every day. And I've won recently. I've gone back to a little bit of competition, and I've won some age group races.
Well, I think that will be helpful steeplechase advice for the vast number of people who are running that. Alan, thanks so much for your time. Anything else you want to say?
I'm very lucky to have as my wife, Karen Strickland, who is one of the nation's leading grassroots organizers. She led the fight to codify Roe versus Wade in Maryland so that women of Maryland are protected no matter what the Supreme Court did. She's former head of the National Endangered Species Coalition and now head of Vote Climate US PAC, a PAC devoted to combating climate change. She's also a 6-foot blonde Ironman triathlete. And I built all my ideas off her. And, you know, we sat on our front stoop for days upon days batting back and forth a very difficult call in 2016. So I would be remiss in closing this without giving a shout out to Karen Strickler, my wife.
It was always a wise thing to do, as well as I'm sure earned. That was Professor Alan Lichtman of American University. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.